A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 176. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about She-Wolf of London. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. She-Wolf of London, it's a werewolf story, although it rapidly becomes a sort of general occult investigation show. And I'm trying to think, Brian, I know we've done vampires, we've done Frankenstein's creature. Is this the first time we've done werewolves?
It's the first time we've done a show that focuses on werewolves. We mentioned them in Hammer House of Horror. They showed up once there, but the first time we're really getting into it, I guess.
Right, that's right. I do remember there was an episode in Hammer House of Horror, yes, with a werewolf. Okay, so here we are with this show. 20 episodes. They run to about 50 minutes each, and they were broadcast in 1990 and 1991. And we have to point out, because it's quite important as we go along with the development of this show, that it was known in the US by a different title. It was called Love and Curses.
Yes, that's right. This is a little bit unusual in the way it was put together, because the first 14 episodes of the 20 were produced in England and released on Universal Television's Hollywood Premiere Network in the States. They were broadcast on Sky One in the UK. But the final 6 episodes were actually moved to LA, and it sort of became an American production and was released and published as an American show, but was actually produced as a British show for the first 14 episodes.
Okay, so it starts off as a British show, or at least a co-production produced here in Britain, but as you say, then moves to Los Angeles for the last 6 episodes. And well, we'll see how we get on. We may struggle slightly with this one, Brian. We'll see.
So the setup for this show, Randy Wallace is an American university student, and she comes to England to study for her master's degree, studying mythology. And she meets this charismatic university professor and moves into the bed and breakfast that he and his family run. So she and the professor are living under the same roof.
And she goes on a camping trip from there, from this bed and breakfast. She goes on a camping trip to some very nearby moors. And we might talk about the geography of that at a later time. But anyway, predictably, you can see this one come in. She's in a tent on camping by herself on the moors, and she's attacked by a large wolf-like creature. And it doesn't take very long for her to be, after her safe return to the university, that she undergoes her own transformation and becomes a werewolf. The only person who knows about this, and the sort of person who helps her with the nature of her curse, is her professor. And together they team up, primarily to try and find a cure for her condition, but basically to keep the show going. Actually, what they end up in doing is becoming a team that investigates spooky goings-on together. Let's put it that way, Brian.
Yes, the premise was that they were going to investigate supernatural goings-on in order to try and find a cure for Randy's curse. And while they mention a number of times that they are looking for this cure, it turns into something where it's much more, you know, this sort of paranormal investigation show. And there is a neat little title sequence that has some visuals that explain the premise and the origin story there as well. So the characters, we mentioned Randy Wallace, played by Kate Hodge, and she's this very keen American student, and she's the she-wolf of the title, of course. Diane Udale plays the wolf version of Randy once the complete transformation has happened.
Yes, that's Diane Udale, better known as Jet from Gladiators to viewers over here in the UK, to men of a certain age, perhaps. Myself and Alan Partridge, big fans of hers. And of course, before getting the job on Gladiators, she was a gymnast, and therefore she does all the sort of throwing herself around and various bits and pieces wearing a large, shaggy wolf suit.
Yes, I think Gladiators came sort of shortly after this for her.
Right. Then we've got the Professor Ian Matheson, who is a charismatic professor of mythology at an unnamed English university, but it's very much a sort of classic old style building. And as we've said, he becomes Randy's collaborator. He's supposed to be supervising her master's thesis, but he ends up supervising her series of investigations and at the same time helping to control her werewolf curse, even to the extent that he locks her in a dungeon, basically, when it's a full moon.
Yes, the place where they live, this bed and breakfast, happens to have this sort of medieval dungeon in the basement, and it's not really explained why, it just happens to be there.
It's very convenient, but it does make the professor-student relationship seem even more dodgy than it already is. But there you go. I should mention that Professor Matheson was played by the actor Neil Dixon, who I think at that time was best known for having played Biggles, British Boy's Own type adventurer hero in the movie of the same name. And there are a couple of jokes that come up later in the series where his character keeps suggesting that they go and watch the film Biggles, but Randy is having none of it.
Ah, yes, of course.
We've also got Ian Matheson's parents, just known, I think, as Mr. and Mrs. Matheson, played by Jean Challice and Arthur Cox. And as we've said, they run a bed and breakfast sort of boarding house. And when Randy's student accommodation arrangements fall through, Ian Matheson invites her to come and live with them, which, as we say, it does stretch student-teacher relationships even more. But as you say, Brian, this incredibly convenient gothic dungeon lockable cellar that he has, so that once a month she can be confined down there, undergo her transformation into a werewolf, not harm anybody, and not be heard by anybody else in the house, which seems a bit strange. But again, we have to swallow a certain amount of implausibility with this one.
Yes, I would say so. The relationship between Randy and Ian in the 14 British episodes is a little strange, because it's a sort of almost a romance, but not quite saying it, that it's really a romance between them. And every once in a while you'll get, you know, oh, well, it's really just student professor. That's all it is. Which is a little bit strange. It dramatically works reasonably well, I would say.
It is, as you say, a little bit peculiar. But yes, they have this flirtatious relationship.
Yes, and sometimes that works reasonably well in the story of it. There are a couple of other characters who are living in the boarding house with them. Aunt Elsa, almost always referred to as Aunt Elsa, Ian's aunt, played by Dorothy Phillips. And she is this sort of eccentric aunt character, but quite fun at times. And there is an American nephew, Julian, played by Scott Foltz, who sort of fills out the Matheson family, and he's sort of the generic, young, annoying American kid who's always getting on everyone else's nerves.
Yes, and he's supposed to, I think, provide some comic relief by making his witty observations about the strange comings and goings of Professor Matheson and Randy. So he occasionally points out, I think, what the audience is thinking. But there you go. So that's our cast and crew. But as we've said, only Randy and Ian make the transition to the last six episodes in America. So the English members of the family are then left behind and forgotten as Randy and Ian travel to America at the same time as the production moved entirely over to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think there's one scene or maybe two scenes where they're still in the UK at the beginning of the, you know, the first of those six episodes that sets up, oh, they're going to LA now. And then after that, you never see any of those British characters again. There is one character who shows up frequently in the American run, and that is Skip Seville, who is this television producer, and we'll get to that a little bit later as we go.
Okay, so as we've said, they're supposedly looking for a cure for Randy's condition. Ian obviously knows about the curse. He's witnessed the effects of her first transformation. And so he does this thing every month at the full moon where he gets even more creepy and locks her in a dungeon. And in order to help her in her search for a cure, they place an ad in the newspaper asking for people with occult experiences to contact them. And that really, I suppose, sets up what's going to happen with the rest of the show and the rest of the episode, certainly for the British episodes.
Yes, that advertisement is mentioned quite frequently, and it sort of sets them up as these, you know, paranormal investigators, and they're hoping to find a cure somewhere along the way. But most of the time, they're just investigating things. And sometimes, fairly quite often, Randy's being a werewolf somehow comes into the story of things. But sometimes it doesn't. And we get this sort of pattern of investigations and the knowledge that they have and the library of books that they have from being specialists in mythology is something that they frequently rely on.
Yes, they're both, in a way, they're both like the Giles character from Buffy in that they're both experts on mythology, Ian particularly so. And so, as you say, Brian, lots of the stuff they encounter, they have got some idea of the history or the legends. And of course, for an occult investigation show, we would expect them to encounter ghosts, which they do, but they also come across zombies and vampires. There's cursed books. Later on, they will find themselves trapped in some sort of haunted movie. There's all manner of sort of classic supernatural tropes to be explored.
Yes, a lot of those come into it. There are some sorcery type things and trolls. They even get into cupids at one point, you know, a wide variety of things showing up.
Okay, and we've mentioned Giles from Buffy. We should point out that this was 1990, 1991. So it was before Buffy the Vampire Slayer on television, and it was before The X-Files, that other, you know, classic occult investigation show with a dynamic duo leading the what's going on, the spooky goings on. So before that...
Although it was after The Omega Factor, which also had that sort of investigating a two-person team with various supernatural things. But this is a very different show from The Omega Factor, and I think has more in common with things like X-Files and maybe especially Buffy that came after it, although I wouldn't put it in the same class as those shows as far as having interesting stories in it goes.
Yeah, I suppose it's a classic idea in a way, the two people investigating supernatural goings-on. I mean, we could even, I suppose, go all the way back to Sherlock Holmes, where he was often investigating what appeared to be supernatural events, but obviously finding, in his case, rational explanations. But the sort of the team looking into this sort of thing, it's clearly a popular idea, Brian.
Yes, absolutely.
And as you say, perhaps mostly the flavour of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but as you're probably gathering as we're going along, I think we'd say that Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a superior show to this one.
Yes, I would have to say so.
No way. I am not taking home some English curse. Damn it. I know what happened last night. It was real. It happened to me. And it means that everything we know is wrong.
Randy, there are no werewolves.
Prove it.
What are you trying to say?
I'm saying that I am not going home. This disease stays until I find a cure. Dr. Matheson! Ian.
So we should get into some of the production notes here. Unfortunately, it's a little tricky to get much information about the production for this one. There isn't a lot of information that's out there. But we do know some things. It was created by two American producers, Tom McLaughlin and Mick Harris, and they were known mostly for American horror films. And it was a co-production, as far as we can tell, with Universal Television's Hollywood Premiere Network and HTV, which was an ITV network.
Yes, from what we can gather, it's that period of time where the independent television network, different companies here in Britain, were starting to explore making shows for other broadcasters. And so they were starting to looking at putting money into television and films which would not necessarily be shown directly on their network. And as you say, we've got HTV being involved with this one. We know that the two producers, McLaughlin and Garris, wrote the pilot episode, and that the first episode was directed by somebody called Dennis Abbey. We've got no real sort of set writers or directors attached to this show. Basically, I think it was just, I suppose, passed around various writers to produce an episode and a variety of different directors. I don't think there's any sort of consistent names.
No, I think that's right.
And then for filming the British episodes, we believe it's Bath and Bristol, which is standing in for London. As far as we can tell, it was filmed in and around Bath and Bristol. They've used, I think, one of the abbeys down there to stand in for Professor Matheson's university. And again, we believe it's supposed to be set in London, but it is set in a sort of Americanized version of London. And the fact that they have this university that looks like Oxford or Cambridge, and as I've said earlier, the fact that Randy can escape very quickly and get out to the moors to go camping on and have her encounter with this wolf creature. But there you go. So that's the way, I suppose, American companies look at filming in England.
Yeah, I guess that's right. It's a bit of an American idealized view of what England should look like.
Yep, I guess so.
So we had music composed by Steve Levine, with a title sequence played over clips of the origin story and various bits of supernatural imagery and of the wolf and the transformation. There were actually at least three different title sequences for this, because there was an American version for the American broadcasts that used a remix of the theme with saxophones in it, and that one had the title Love and Curses rather than She-Wolf of London. And that was very much sort of fitting in that borderline 1980s, 1990s area with the saxophone theme, for sure. The British version of that title sequence, a very similar set of clips, but the more spooky theme music without the saxophone in it, and of course the British title. And in those final six episodes, they used a completely different title sequence with Love and Curses as the title.
As you say, with the saxophone, with the Americanized versions we've been watching on the DVD sets we've been looking at, it's the tail end of the 1980s, so I guess it had to have a saxophone in it. But it is... well, it's one of the cheesiest title sequences that we've seen. Certainly I have, and I'm not sure if we've seen a worse title sequence in British Invaders as yet, but maybe our listeners know better.
Yeah, as far as theme music goes, between this and Star Cops, which Star Cops was a great series, but the theme music from that and the theme music from this would both be somewhere near the bottom of the list, I think. The imagery in that title sequence, I thought, was quite good, with the possible exception of that one shot where they managed to make the werewolf, which which look good in those 14 episodes. Quite good werewolf makeup, but they managed to make that werewolf have 1980s hair. I don't know how, but in that one shot, they did.
Fantastic. 1980s saxophone and 1980s hair. Yes, I mean, you're quite right. The way they retell the origin in the titles is fine. It's the cheesy music and some of the other imagery that they put with it that spoils it for me.
Yes, that's fair enough. As we will discuss more as we go with this, the visuals, the way it's produced in those first 14 episodes, the cinematography is quite good and does some spooky things quite well, and some very good work with the look of the werewolf and the transformation to the werewolf. So this was broadcast on the Sky One satellite network in the UK, which at that time was starting to become a little more broadly available to the British public. It was the beginning of the sort of expanded set of channels becoming more broadly available in England.
Okay. Now, we know that at some point, the European producers and the European money pulled out and decided not to continue with the series. And presumably this must have been at some point while they were actually in production. And so the American producers took what was left of the first series and took it to Los Angeles, as we've said. So both the production moved to Los Angeles and the setting of the show moved to Los Angeles. And that was for the last six episodes. As we've said, they get this explanation as to why Randy and Ian have been moved back to America, and they say goodbye to the British family, and off they go, and they have six more adventures in Los Angeles, where Ian is supposed to be hosting a TV chat show about the occult, which is the device, I suppose, that leads them into some of their investigations there.
Yes, again, they are now doing that to get into these investigations and to hopefully find a cure for Randy. But it does, in those last six episodes, feel like a completely different series that just happens to have these two characters and a little bit of their story from the earlier episodes, you know, pasted into it.
Yes, it is. And we, you know, we'll talk about that a bit more in the next episode. But yes, it does seem to be a completely different show almost once it gets to Los Angeles.
So we should talk about the availability of this one. There is a Region 1 DVD release that came out in 2010. It has the 20 episodes with the American Love and Curses titles to it. The packaging of the DVDs list both titles, She-Wolf of London and Love and Curses, but the actual title sequence is the American Love and Curses version with the saxophone on it. If you want to see the British title sequence for the first 14 episodes, you need to watch that on YouTube or some such thing. There are basically no bonus materials on this. It just gives you the episodes themselves. It sells on Amazon.com for around $10 and Amazon.ca for about $24.
Okay, so that's Region 1. Over here in Region 2, nothing. No DVD set for Region 2, but you can import that Region 1 box set, or it is available to buy actually on Amazon.co.uk. Currently down to about £12 for the same box set. And the price seems to be falling, so you can probably get hold of it reasonably cheaply. It's not available on the rental sites here, so no Netflix or Love Film. There are bits and pieces on YouTube. I haven't seen whole episodes up there, but you can see moments from the show, including transformations. And of course, you can have the great joy of going to YouTube and watching those cheesy saxophone opening credit sequences, which are the most early, you know, the most 90s thing you'll see, I think, Brian.
And you can see how dramatic the difference is between that British title sequence without the saxophone theme and the American one that does use it. It's quite a stark difference when you change that. So next time, we will look at the differences between the two parts of this series, the British run and the American run, in a little more detail. We'll also talk a bit more about the similarities between this and X-Files and Buffy and so on. And we'll talk about our favorite episodes and some of the things we liked and didn't like.
Okay. We will, of course, give our own reviews and recommendations about this show and whether you should try and get hold of it. And also maybe deal with some of your feedback about it as well.
Yes, absolutely. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. We are part of the Geek Culture Network, so if you go to thegeekculturenetwork.com, you can find us there. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us that way as well. And we have some good discussions with our listeners going there.
We're also proud members of vognetwork.com, which is the Voice of Geeks streaming radio show. Lots of geek-related shows to listen to there, including our own British Invaders. We go out on Mondays and Tuesday nights on vognetwork.com.
So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, this is Eamon in England also signing off.